In conclusion, this paper has attempted to point out that Richard Tavener's Protestantism is evidenced in his writings. Also, Morrison's and Starkey's familiarity with the works of Luther and their Protestant proclivities encouraged them to insert Lutheran ideas into the propaganda pieces they composed for the government during the 1530s. A pervasive covert theme which emphasizes scriptural reading as the imperative component of religious understanding is found in all of the documents. This could in no way be mistaken for just Erasmian humanist reform, since Morrison and Starkey both repeatedly refer to a justification based on faith alone and are at pains to denounce the merits of good works, the merit of good works. They heap abuse on the Pope and refer to the Catholic Church as the strumpet of Babylon while praising Henry's assumed advocacy of the new religion, or quote, true religion. Morrison actually credits the government's victory in the Pilgrimage of Grace to God's appreciation of England's Protestantism. The anti-Protestant turn of events in the reaction of 1539 and 40 dashed any hope of a Lutheran Protestant England. Nonetheless, in a hitherto unnoticed way, these documents point up the strong Protestantism of the government's chief propagandists in the early English Reformation, and they help to illuminate the genuine religiosity in the propagandist makers of Tudor policy. Thank you.
I shall now read President Howell's paper, and at the conclusion we can receive questions and comments. Sir Philip Sidney and his circle played an apparently central role in the expression of the Protestant activist position. Yet Sidney's own relation to the Protestant cause varied significantly during his short career. Initially, there can be little doubt that Sidney was seen as the potential leader of the movement. By the late 1570s, he was being employed not so much as the potential leader, but as a respectable spokesman for policies that were known to be offensive to the Queen. In the 1580s, when international events allowed the Protestant War Party to take the lead temporarily, Sidney was one of its military commanders. By this time, however, his thinking had deviated from his original simplistic views on the advisability of a Protestant League, although he was to become, through his death, a glorious symbol of the Protestant cause. His own development had led him to more complex, though perhaps equally naive, thoughts. Sidney's education was such that he was raised with a deep interest in the Protestant cause. He imbibed his Calvin while a schoolboy at Shrewsbury. The influence of Leicester on his early political formulations was marked, and above all, he learned his lessons in European statesmanship from the wily Burgundian Hubert Languet, who was long one of the leading proponents of Protestant union. At this point in his career, however, it is apparent that the real interest in Sidney lay in the hope that he would emerge as the leader of the Protestant cause. Certainly his prospects were dazzling, and Languet, for one, was open in his use of those prospects in purely political terms. The attention paid to Sidney as the potential leader of the Protestant activist group is also revealed clearly in the abortive attempts to arrange a marriage between him and the daughter of the Prince of Orange. For his part, Sidney attempted to play a useful role in the development of a Protestant League. His 1577 embassy into Germany, officially intended to convey Elizabeth's condolences to the emperor on his father's death, became, in practice, primarily concerned with the Protestant alliance system advocated by the activist group. His visit to William of Orange at the conclusion of his embassy was used to the same purpose, and for a considerable period afterwards, Sidney remained the principal link between Orange and the Earl of Leicester. Even in 1581, Leicester was still grooming Sidney to succeed him, if not in title and estate, at least in political leadership and obligations of literary patronage. It does appear, however, that by the late 1570s, the activist group had found another use for Sidney. Because of his connections and literary abilities, he was increasingly used as the respectable spokesman for the activist position. This is shown clearly, for example, at the time of the French marriage negotiations. Sidney's famous letter to the Queen opposing the match was his own composition, but hardly his own idea. Sidney was to confess later to Longuet that he had written the letter to the Queen at the command of those he felt obliged to obey. There can be little doubt that they were Walsingham and Leicester. Sidney's role as front man did not end here. In their perceptive book, Leicester's Triumph, R.C. Strong and J.A. Van Dorsten have traced the elaborate charade of England's increasing involvement in the Netherlands revolt, a charade culminating in Leicester's being invested with the same de facto authority in the Netherlands, which Elizabeth consistently refused. In the complicated maneuvering and double dealing which marked these negotiations, Sidney played his part, helping to pave the way and eventually trying to explain to the Queen what had been done. Through his involvement in these schemes of the Protestant activists, though his involvement in these schemes of the Protestant activists seems clear, Sidney himself had begun to display differences in outlook from the other members of the activist group. This is revealed in two related ways. In the first place, his conception of a Protestant League seems to have been increasingly ecumenical. In the second place, he ceased to regard the Netherlands as the only, or indeed as the central issue in the struggle. That Sidney's general conception of the Protestant League changed in later life seems probable in view of his developing ideas about religion. Sidney himself was not in any sense of the word a systematic thinker, and he left behind no carefully constructed statement of his religious views. But his relations with Giordano Bruno and Daniel Rogers are suggestive. What was it that drew Sidney and Bruno together? Bruno had strong anti-Petrarchan inclinations, and to the extent to which Sidney's Astrophel and Stella was in the Petrarchan tradition, this would have stood as a barrier. Moreover, it is clear that Bruno, not wholly the herald of the new science, defended novel positions on the basis of mysticism. It has been argued that far from being the father of an unfettered thought, he was more nearly the last of the great magicians. To the extent Sidney may have identified Bruno's mysticism with superstition, this aspect of Bruno's thought would hardly have encouraged close contact with Sidney. For it is clear from Sidney's own writings that he was a convinced opponent of superstition, and hence should have been repelled rather than attracted by the pronounced mystical element in Bruno's work. Yet it is apparent that there were qualities in Bruno's thought that strongly appealed to Sidney, notably the ideas connected with Christian Hermetism. Hermetism has now, of course, been clearly identified as the central component in Bruno's thought. What is less well appreciated is that Hermetism in its religious form tended to play down the mystical element, which would have been so objectionable to Sidney. The mystical element, of course, remained large in Bruno's own work. But that it was religious Hermetism which drew the two together seems likely in view of some of Sidney's known relations. It is certain, for example, that Sidney was deeply interested in the religious speculations of the Frenchman Monet. Sidney began a translation of the latter's De la Vérité de la Religion Chrétienne, and that work summed up in a reference to the works of the alleged author of the Hermetic writings, The Faith of Christian Hermetism. Quote, Mercurius Trismegistus, who, if the books which are fathered upon him be his indeed, as in truth they be very ancient, is the founder of them all, teacheth everywhere that there is but one God. that one is the root of all things, and that without that one, nothing hath been of all things that are, that the same one is called the only good and goodness itself, which hath universal power of creating all things, that it is impossible that there should be many makers, end of quote. Equally telling in this respect is Sidney's connection with Daniel Rogers. Rogers had had close contact with continental exponents of this sort of thinking. Moreover, evidence has come to light which shows that Rogers not only established connections with the Sidney Circle, but also suggests that such ideas were current in the discussions of that group. It is probable that Rogers was brought into contact with Sidney through the agency of their common friend Longuet. By 1578, their contact was close. In that year, Sidney wrote to Longuet, quote, I pray you to love my friend Rogers more and more for my sake, end of quote. During the 1570s, Rogers addressed half a dozen poems to Sidney and became an intimate enough companion so that the Dutch poet and historian Baldius could write to thank Rogers for introducing him, quote, into the familia of the illustrious knight Sir Philip Sidney. Where the contact became most close was in the informal gathering, the Areopagus. While some literary historians have suggested that the Areopagus was no more than an Elizabethan in-joke, there is, in fact, more than enough evidence to demonstrate its existence. Furthermore, it is important to note that the group was more than the mere literary circle it is sometimes described as being. To be sure, it did experiment with classical prosody, the dranting of English verse. They studied divine poetry, and they sought the creation of an integrated poetry and music. But they also discussed policy and religion. As Rogers notes, quote, nor are you without a faithful and happy circle of companions in whom, in close friendship, there abounds a pious love. With them you discuss great points of law, God, or moral good when time permits these pious studies. Such concerns had been common also in the Paris circles in which Rogers moved. It seems reasonable to conclude that it was in this fashion that Sidney was exposed directly to Christian Hermetism and to the idea of an ecumenical religious movement. In this respect, we can perceive his thoughts on the idea of a Protestant League broadening from a mere desire to unify some Protestants against the Catholic threat to an overall desire for the reunification of Christendom. One further piece of evidence should be analyzed as an indication that Sidney's religious thought was tending in the direction of Christian Hermetism. Sidney was clearly familiar with texts such as those by Mornay and Ramus, which cited pre-Christian writers in order to show their conformity with Christian doctrine. Greville relates how Sidney, on his deathbed, had asked the clergyman in attendance, quote, to deliver the opinion of the ancient heathen touching the immortality of the soul, in order to parallel with it the most pregnant authorities of the Old and the New Testament. This clearly suggests that Sidney approved of the ancient theology. The Arcadia confirms this supposition, especially in the character of Pamela. She is portrayed as being already in a Christian frame of mind and is to be understood as a good pagan who had reached the truth by natural reason and was preaching it. Such ideas as these had a profound influence on Sidney's developing conception of foreign policy. The pan-Christian thrust of his religious thinking led him to contemplate not merely an alliance with the German princes, not merely aid to the Dutch rebels, but the possibility of a European-wide movement built on exposure of the iniquities of Spain. But if the policy being suggested by Sidney was indeed built in part on the principles of ecumenical religion, why did not the proposed league aim at a total pan-Christian movement against the Turk? Ultimately, perhaps it would have. The battle against the Turk could have been the final rallying point for the reunification of Christianity. But in practice, the thrust of Sidney's argument was against Spain. He saw the Spanish monarchy as a European Ottoman power. Philip II was another Suleiman, and hence beyond the pale even of an ecumenical movement. There can be no doubt that political calculation was important in reaching this stance. Sidney, like other members of the Protestant activist group, betrayed a distinctly political religiosity in his animosity to Spain. For some members of the group, it is plausible to suggest that their militant Protestantism was derived from political opposition to Spain rather than the other way around. Sidney's thought, however, appears to show that beneath the political level, there was, in his case, still an intense religious justification for what he proposed. Sidney, like some in his own time in many sense, was appalled by the cruelty of the Spanish conquest and the nature of the colonial rule which subsequently was established. But not only were the Spanish iniquitous, they were also, Sidney felt, hypocritical, and because of this subject to the vengeance of God, which must, quote, necessarily hang over those hypocritical cruelties which, under color of converting souls to him, sent millions of better than their own, they cared not whither, and instead of spreading Christian religion by good life, committed such terrible inhumanities as gave those that lived under nature manifest occasion to abhor the devilly character of so tyrannical a deity. In short, the Spanish had transgressed divine and natural law by attempting to fit them to their own uses, and the vengeance of God would surely fall on them, aided in this world by the arms of England. That Spain stood convicted in Sidney's mind for violation of natural and divine law may well have seemed sufficient cause for a Christian league against them. But even Sidney realized that this scheme had its fanciful aspect. He admitted that the plan might seem of too high a nature or too many chargeable parts. Because of this, he had had a second, and he thought, preferable line of approach to curbing Spain. The second approach also involved some differentiation from the main arguments being advanced by the Protestant activists in the council, who were so concerned with the Netherlands problem. The present policy of England, with its half-hearted support of the revolt in the Netherlands, was, Sidney had come to think, the least likely way to achieve a limit on Spain's ambition. Here we can see Sidney's ideas deviating in significant fashion from his original conception of foreign policy. Initially, he had seemed to think, in common with other Protestant activist leaders, that the struggle in the Netherlands was the basic one, the arena where the Spanish beast could be most successfully baited. It was the view in which he had been so patiently encouraged by Languet and others. Now, however, he came to think that no matter how grand the involvement of the Protestants in the Netherlands, this was simply the wrong place to attempt to engage Spain. Quote, he providently determined that while Spain had peace, a pope, money or credit, and the world men, necessity or humors, the war could hardly be determined upon this low country stage. Instead, Sidney suggested, a plan should be followed which involved invading, possessing, and inhabiting, quote, some well-chosen haven in Peru, Mexico, or both. If the conquest should not proceed smoothly, the accompanying fleet would at least wreak havoc among the Spaniards in the region. Greville asserts that Sidney's scheme actually proceeded well into the planning stage, that he had persuaded the United Provinces to assist in the plan to the extent of sending a fleet of their own, and that he had persuaded 30 of the magnates of England to provide funds for the expedition, though Greville's total subscription figure of £3,000 was, of course, ridiculously out of proportion to the actual cost of such an operation. This reconstruction of Sidney's thoughts on foreign relations rests substantially on Greville's account. Is it to be trusted, or is it possible that Greville, writing many years later, saw both the catastrophe of English involvement in the Netherlands and the ultimate success of Elizabethan sea warfare, and decided to give to his hero a view of foreign policy that seemed more in accord with the way things had worked out than one which centered on intervention in the Netherlands? There is certain evidence which suggests strongly that Sidney did, in fact, take the New World policy seriously. In the first place, there is his known and documented interest in the New World. For example, he wrote to Longuet as early as 1578, quote, for my own part, unless God powerfully counteract it, I seem to myself to see our cause withering away, and I am now meditating with myself some Indian project. 2 years earlier than this, he had invested in a voyage of Frobisher. In 1577, he wrote enthusiastically to Longuet that Frobisher had discovered gold in the New World, though this proved to be a false report. It is interesting to note that already at this time, Sidney saw the possession and exploitation of a New World gold-producing area as the critical element in furthering the Protestant cause. Quote, the thing is truly of great importance, he noted to Longuet, and one which may probably, some time or other, be of use to the professors of the true religion. And then, too, there is the hint afforded by Sidney's contacts with Dr. John Dee. In Dee, Sidney would have found one who could readily agree with and encourage his New World schemes. No man in England was, in fact, better suited to act as technical advisor for overseas voyaging than Dee was. Two specific projects undertaken by Sidney seem also to confirm the reality of this New World policy. One was his involvement in 1582 in the plans of Sir Humphrey Gilbert, Sir George Peckham, and Sir Thomas Gerard for the establishment of a Catholic colony in the New World. It is, of course, possible that Sidney saw the scheme simply as a matter of financial investment, or that he saw it, as Walsingham did, solely as a clever device for coping with the internal Catholic threat. But the conjunction of the scheme with his conception of a New World colony as being, quote, an emporium for the confluence of all nations that love or profess any kind of virtue or commerce is at least suggestive. The second specific project, which tends to confirm the authenticity of Sidney's New World policy, is his involvement in Drake's 1585 voyage. According to Greville's account, the whole expedition was of Sidney's, quote, own projecting, wherein he fashioned the whole body with purpose to become head of it himself. The proposed voyage with Drake is one of the most celebrated episodes in Sidney's career, but it is not easy to make a balanced judgment of it. The role of Drake himself remains something of a mystery. What sort of agreement did he really make with Sidney? Why did he encourage Sidney to come to Plymouth and then secretly inform the court in an attempt to get rid of him. The results of Sidney's not going with the expedition seem more open to analysis. Greville, in looking back on the affair, could only lament that his friend had not had a chance to put his ambitious schemes into practice. But a modern judgment vindicating Drake's resolves not to have Sidney sail with him is far more acute. Quote, Drake was right. Naval experience was essential to the success of the enterprise, and a fleet commanded by a sailor, an idealist, and an exiled prince would have steered straight to disaster. One further piece of evidence can be offered to suggest that Sidney took the New World project seriously. This is his letter to Plantin, dated in his collected works as 1580-81, but more certainly to be dated between 1584 and 86 at the time his overseas scheme was maturing. Two books mentioned in the letter are readily identifiable: Abraham Ortelius's Theatrum Orbis Terrarum and Speculum Nauticum, the first book containing printed maritime charts. A third volume mentioned in the letter is more difficult to identify, since no single work published by Plantin before 1586 corresponds exactly to Sidney's description. Two works approximate the description: Guicciardini's Description de Tous les Pays-Bas and Pacino's Discours sur plusieurs points de l'architecture de guerre. The reference in the letter to fortresses suggests that the latter may well be the work in question. It is noteworthy that the books concerned were ideally suited to the enterprise which Greville says Sidney planned in the New World. The Pacino work can be connected plausibly with Sidney's proposed strategy, since he advocated not only the capture, but also the retention and fortification of Spanish seaports. It seems likely, then, that on the eve of his departure for the Netherlands campaign, Sidney had come to think of the Protestant cause in ways that diverged from many of the Protestant activists. The Netherlands campaign was no longer to him the central issue. He had shifted his views to a more naval New World policy. His religious conceptions seemed to have become more pan-Christian than those of his associates. Still, he was to go to the Netherlands to meet his death there in a relatively insignificant skirmish. There is a nice irony in the fact that Sidney became, through his death, the much-exploited symbol of the dramatic courage of the Protestant cause. Unable to lead the cause in his lifetime and altering his own view of the nature of that cause, he became, in death, its unqualified hero and symbol. A statesman of limited achievement, a courtier for the most part without constructive employment, a Protestant with ecumenical inclinations, a warrior killed in his first campaign on what he thought was the secondary battleground, Sidney was to be transformed and posthumously into Philistides, the peerless shepherd knight who had kept the grim wolf from Eliza's door, Eliza's gate. Now, are there any questions, comments?
The first paper will be given by Professor William Wright, The Impact of the Reformation on Hessian Education. Professor Wright is a member of the Department of History at the University of Tennessee in Chattanooga. Earned his Ph.D. degree under the direction of Professor Harold Grimm at Ohio State University in 1959, and has since then published an article in a recent issue of the 16th Century Journal. He's continuing his research on the question of Reformation influence on Hessian education.
Thank you.
Are we to permit none but louts and bores to rule when we can do better than that? This rather contemporary sounding comment was actually the words of Martin Luther. And in these words, he directly meant to challenge the politicians of his day to educate the young. For, he said, it is pleasing to God that princes, lords, councilmen, and others in authority be educated and qualified to perform the functions of their offices. It was necessary, Luther wrote, for those in authority to educate the young, because many parents would not do it, others were incompetent to do so, others did not have the time, and that was not to mention orphans. One of those politicians who responded to the challenge of Luther was Philip the Magnanimous of Hesse. This paper will attempt to show that in the years 1526 to 1537, Philip, following Lutheran advice, organized a territorial system of public education consisting of state Latin grammar schools and a university. This thesis is in contrast to some earlier thinking on the subject. Georg Schmidt, in 1905, maintained that the ordering of schools consisted of the University of Marburg, the pedagogium that I will describe later, Latin grammar schools, and village schools. Wilhelm Wolff, in 1911, saw a similar ordering under Philip, and in particular, claimed that Philip had created 7 village schools by the end of his reign. By village schools, these men meant an elementary German school. Wolff associated these village schools with catechism classes, often called Kusterschulen or Sexton schools, arguing that a little education in German reading and writing was necessary in order to learn the catechism. In this argument, then, the village schools represented the origin of the later Volksschulen, or the system of universal, compulsory, elementary German schools that was formally established in most German territories in the 17th or 18th centuries. There were, of course, schools in Hesse prior to the Reformation, and these were roughly of 3 types: church, city, and German schools. Church and city schools offered a Latin grammar preparatory education, while in the latter, youth might learn as much German as Latin. The German schools offered only an elementary vernacular education. They were variously maligned as Beischulen, Klipschulen, and Winkelschulen where they existed in cities, while village schools and girls' schools must also usually be termed as German schools. The 15th century saw the Brethren of the Common Life and Renaissance ideas make a profound impact on Hessian schools. By the 1520s, however, these impulses for education had passed their apex and schools were in decline. The Hessian chronicler, Wigan Lausner, described this decline of schools and education, and he explained some of the reasons for it in his recollections of the year 1527. Lausner reported that the youth had been deceived and many now sought to learn trades rather than attend school. Thereby, generally in the territory and in the cities, he said, classical studies are falling and becoming extinct. The schools are turned into wastelands, and nobody wants to keep his children in school anymore. And the highly necessary arts, together with the learned, come to be greatly hated and despised by the common man. As Lausser reported, one reason for the decline of education was the rise of a practical mentality in the cities, which saw little use for learning classical Latin, much less studying Terence and Cicero. Philip, indeed, continued to meet this objection as in Kassel, where the city objected to high or difficult reading and felt that learned teachers only became, quote, vexed and tired with the boys, unquote. The Reformation itself, however, was also a cause for this decline. Most important here was a tendency, especially on the left wing of the movement, to distrust reason and belittle education in classical languages. It was particularly to combat these threats to classical education that Luther and Melanchthon clearly articulated and promoted the religious and secular application of such an education. Their positive arguments for education are well known and need not be recited, except to emphasize that Luther argued that education was a worldly thing demanded by reason and natural law. Order in society demanded education. Luther's great pamphlets demanding that the authorities organize proper schools were widely available. In addition to these, Philip of Hesse also received the direct advice of Melanchthon, from whom he requested it on a chance meeting in 1524. The important Strasbourg reformer, Martin Bucer, has also been associated with Hessian schools, and even cited as the father of the Hessian Volksschule. To associate Bucer with Philip's school plans in general is misleading, however, because Bucer had no influence on Hessian affairs prior to 1537, while Philip's school plans had been formulated and already put into effect by that time. Furthermore, three important ideas in the area of school reform promoted by Bucer and his fellow reformers at Strasbourg had little or no impact on Hesse. First, the creation of a special territorial school supervisor called the Schulherr, or Scholarken. Second, the procuration of privately supported endowments for schools and scholarships. And third, the establishment of German schools separate from the Latin ones. In fact, influence in school affairs may well have moved the other way, as one notes that Bucer held Marburg and Hesse up as an example of Strasbourg in an advisory report to the city council in 1534. With regard to the Volksschule, it has been argued that these schools evolved from the compulsory universal catechism instruction introduced in Hesse by the Ziegenhain Order of Discipline and the Kassel Church Order of the year 1539, both of which Bucer helped prepare. To associate the universal catechism instruction required by these orders with the later Volksschulen is misleading, however, for it is to imply that elementary German instruction was a major part of the curriculum in these classes. This was not the case, nor was it the intent, for Digon Lautzer clearly stated in his chronicle that these were catechism classes whose primary purpose was religious, namely, to teach doctrine and prepare the young for adult membership in the church. These catechism classes were thus quite unlike the Lehrhäuser, or teaching houses of Strasbourg, in which the primary purpose was to render elementary German instruction. Furthermore, these catechism classes were taught by the pastors, elders, or sextons, for which reason they have all too often been referred to as Küsterschulen, or sexton schools, as I said before. Finally, in one section of Hesse, we might note the upper Grafschaft of Kassel-Elmbogen, it has been shown that the Volksschulen were only established after the death of Philip and the last superintendent appointed there by Philip, because both of these men were opposed to such schools. Convinced early by the Wittenberg reformers of the need for educated subjects and of his responsibility as a prince for promoting education, Philip of Hesse planned a territorial school system. He first indicated that he would follow their advice in a letter written to the Wittenberg theologians in September of 1526. The first well-developed plan for the school system appeared in December of that year in the Reformation of the Hessian Church, which was Philip's plan for an entire new church state settlement. As interesting as this document is, time allows one only to say that the school plans found in it were almost all carried out, while the theories behind them were never altered. The Reformation itself was not enacted as law. However, the basic school plans found in it were enacted in a number of edicts, some applying to the entire territory, some dealing with individual cities, and culminating in section 13 of the Landgrave's Order of 1537. This section, entitled, appropriately enough, On Schools, was the most comprehensive statement on school reform promulgated by Philip, for which reason it has been described as the basic law of the Hessian school system. Within a decade of his original plan, Philip promoted the establishment of state or public schools for boys, supervised the employment of capable schoolmasters, attempted to adequately support state schools and schoolmasters by providing regular annual salaries, demanded that the Latin grammar curriculum be employed in all of these state schools and establish a scholarship system to help poor boys. The Landgrave made the territorial visitors, called the superintendents after the year 1531, his major agents in the supervision of schools. More government men than Luther had recommended, the Hessian superintendents were the Landgrave's church-state officials, and they served as the main instruments of princely paternalism in all spiritual as well as educational matters, so that educational matters were simply an additional task for them. In a number of edicts, the superintendents were instructed first to admonish or compel cities to establish and maintain schools. They worked within the cities wherever there was cooperation and compelled reluctant cities to obey the Landgrave's orders, culminating in the Comprehensive Order of 1537. The superintendents were involved in all phases of establishing and maintaining state schools. The appointment of schoolmasters, pay of the same, and supervision of curriculum and discipline were all within their bailiwick. On the other hand, the Landgrave officials disapproved of private schools. Quote, "For what diligence and trouble is turned to private schools is lacked in public ones," unquote. In another case, the superintendents expressed even greater opposition to such schools. Quote, "German boys' schools which bring detriment to the Latin ones shall not be permitted," unquote. The territorial government set the standards, and the superintendent saw these were followed. This was the case in the selection of schoolmasters. The order of 1537 specifically listed the qualifications of teachers. Quote, "One shall fill the schools with capable, pious, learned, God-fearing people, and provide for their bodily nourishment and needs, so that they do not become negligent, lazy, or indolent in their work or service, but are maintained true and willing." Too bad more school boards and boards of trustees haven't read that document. The cities made the selection, providing they selected, quote, "capable men." Perhaps the most happy example of the interrelation of city and territorial state was the cooperation at Alsfeld, where the superintendents, council, and representatives from the common citizenry met together in the year 1536 to select their schoolmaster. The same basic interrelationship prevailed in providing the salaries for schoolmasters and their aides. No general pay scale was established for the entire territory. Rather, the superintendents were to make the necessary arrangements in each city. It was in this sense that Philip instructed the visitors in 1527 to see to it that, quote, "the schoolmaster and his aides are provided for as best as can be arranged in each place," unquote. The order of 1537, as quoted above in connection with teacher qualifications, did not alter this arrangement. The Landgrave, from the beginning, expected the cities to help support state schools. It has been maintained that those cities which did were simply exceptions. However, there is positive evidence that these following cities all definitely shared in support of their state schools: Alsfeld, Kassel, Wetter, Schmalkalden, Nida, Felsberg, and Holmberg-Forderhohen. In some cases, it was a small portion, and in some cases, it was connected with additional positions, such as city secretary. But the point that I wish to make here is that Philip did try to cajole the cities to pay, and that some, in fact, did share the burden of supporting schoolmasters. Sequestered monastic and church properties and revenues represented a major source of support for Hessian schools, however. Monastic properties and revenues were dealt with by a territorial diet in the year 1527. The state schools in Marburg, Eschwege, Butzbach, and Kassel were all supported in part by monastic properties and revenues. The superintendents made arrangements for the use of these various church revenues, especially benefices, with individual cities. These were usually used to supplement the schoolmaster's income so that he would remain, quote, "true and willing." Rothenburg, Neukirchen, and Eschwege are all examples of the use of benefices in this manner for the support of schools. There was opposition to this use of church revenues in some places, where citizens preferred to use these funds for more practical purposes, such as building city walls or bridges. These seem more important than schools to many people. The territorial government made it clear, however, that this would not be allowed, arguing as follows, quote, "The priestly revenues were originally endowed for the support of preachers, chaplains, and schoolmasters," unquote. Church revenues for vigils, prayers for the dead, anniversary masses, alms, and church buildings were all allocated to common chests for the care of the poor in the year 1527. Very shortly thereafter, however, they were used to help support schoolmasters. This was true at Wetter, Allendorf, Alsfeld, and Eschwegen. The demands that cities support schools, the use of monastic and church properties and revenues, and the use of common chest funds were all in keeping with the advice of Wittenberg in these matters. A third, though minor, source of support utilized in Hesse was tuition. The Landgrave Order of 1537 demanded that this be regulated. The most important point to make about Philip's reform of school support is that he did attempt to provide schoolmasters with suitable salaries, and that at least on an individual basis, the Landgrave government attempted to guarantee to each teacher an annual salary. Prior to the Reformation, it should be pointed out, and on the other hand, most teachers in private and city schools had depended upon tuition, which was rarely fixed, while some, luck was told, had depended upon occasional payments for church-related services, such as singing at funerals and the like. Philip promoted and approved of only one type of curriculum in the schools, Latin grammar school curriculum with religious instruction. This was the curriculum recommended by Luther and thoroughly articulated and promoted by Melanchthon. School reform began in Marburg in 1527 with the establishment of the University of Marburg and an exemplary and special Latin grammar school called the Pedagogium. The unique nature of the latter institution will be discussed in a later context. These schools were jointly conceived, and other state schools were to imitate the Pedagogium. Both Marburg institutions used the curricular ideas of Melanchthon, as was specifically stated by Philip himself at a later date. To ensure that the Pedagogium properly prepared its students for entrance into the university, the professors of the university were given strict control over the Pedagogium. It was then the task of the superintendent to ensure that the example set in the Pedagogium would be carried out in other state schools across the territory. The Landgrave Order of 1537 was definitive in this matter. It called upon the superintendent to arrange every school according to the dictates of the professors, quote, so that the youth may be taught and encouraged in one way, unquote. In effect, then, not only were all the state schools preparatory Latin grammar schools in Hesse, but the curriculum was standardized, and it was standardized as that recommended by Melanchthon. The curriculum of the Hessian schools consisted of the classical and the religious. Classical Latin grammar, literature and history, and doctrinal study, Bible study, and connected religious services for students. This was not a random combination. In fact, the classical Latin emphasis was the core, or what Luther understood as education in languages, holding the secular and religious purposes for education together. The central importance given to Latin can be seen in the related church services for students, if nothing else, which were also the occasion for practice in Latin, singing, and Latin Bible reading. That Philip clearly understood this emphasis may be seen in his unflagging support for the liberal arts and languages, which he declared in 1529 would be maintained even against those who wish that only religious subjects be taught. Contemporary Hessians were well aware of the importance of languages, and Luther's argument for them, too, as can be seen by using Lautze again and his description of the events of 1527. Languages were not only necessary for training preachers, Lautze explained, but, quote, to set up good worldly rule, unquote, for they allow one to study the laws, said Lautze, of Rome, Sparta, and Athens. The territorial government provided scholarships from state funds to make this Latin grammar school and university education available to poor boys also. The stipend orders show that boys on scholarships were being prepared to pass an examination for entrance into the university. Furthermore, these orders frequently emphasized the importance of good schools and the classical curriculum. The pedagogium was forced into a unique role, as I said before. This unique role was that of preparing boys for university study from schools that did not yet meet the standards. This was necessary for most boys in the early period, when the state schools were only being organized. By the year 1546, boys from Kassel, Vetter, Eschwege, and Holmberg, and the city of Schmalkalden, all could pass the examinations, and the Landgrave officials were satisfied that these schools then were meeting the standards. However, the rest of the city schools, or I should call them state schools, throughout Hessen were not, and they were very disappointed with these, so that the pedagogium had to continue to be a special institution. Probably because this situation made it difficult for beginning Marburg boys to compete, a second special Latin school was created in the city of Marburg for this latter purpose, offering only an elementary Latin education. This special school was called the Seminar, or quite often, the Marburg City School. Both the pedagogium and the seminar, however, were Latin grammar schools, utilizing the Melanchthon curriculum. In conclusion, the Lutheran argument for the necessity of education motivated Philip of Hesse to establish a system of state schools which taught the classical curriculum described by Melanchthon. For the most part, church and city schools were reorganized into state schools and hence disappeared. Philip did not promote state schools or Volksschulen or the elementary compulsory German school. In Kassel, during the embarrassment of his imprisonment, Philip was forced by the citizenry to allow the city to establish a German elementary school. But this was an exception under duress. The state also disapproved, as I said, of private schools, although these continued to exist surely. Furthermore, some of the state schools were trivial schools, that is to say, did not meet the standards, did not prepare students in the quadrivium as well as the trivium. This was not by design of the territorial government, but simply because these schools failed yet to fully prepare their students for university entrance. It was to upgrade these failing schools that the superintendents worked with the cities throughout Philip's reign to improve salaries and to employ better men to teach in them. Philip then, I would conclude saying, wished to be considered no lout and board. As he wrote in August of 1529 in the first statute of the University of Marburg, indeed the learned subjects can as little be set as the sun may disappear out of the entire world. Without them, no society, man or manner of life can exist. And this seems to answer Luther's challenge. And correct is he who calls the state fortunate in which philosophers rule and kings begin to philosophize. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Wright. Our second paper this afternoon moves us slightly to the east geographically. Professor Leslie Zamonkosh of the Department of History of Youngstown State University earned his PhD at Notre Dame University under the direction of Canon Astaghfirullah. And he developed there an interest in the history of universities and in education in the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance.
He's particularly interested now in working on the intellectual and cultural life of Corvinian Hungary on the eve of the Battle of Mohács, and his paper today is The State of Education in Hungary on the eve of that battle in 1526. Various aspects of cultural and educational history in Hungary, but no work focuses on the period between the death of Matthias Corvinus in 1490 and the Battle of Mohács in 1526. Therefore, I shall attempt to fill this lacuna by focusing on education in Hungary, encompassing all levels from university training down to the village school. The 36 years under discussion are generally considered an age of decline and decadence in the history of Hungary, culminating in the defeat of Hungarian forces and the death of King Louis II on the battlefield of Mohács. The decadence and decline during this period is not difficult to explain. The strong and centralized state forged by Matthias Corvinus did not survive his death, and the decline began almost immediately. The designated heir of Matthias, his illegitimate son John, was rejected by the majority of the nobility, who instead invited the Jagiellonian prince Ladislaus II to become their king. Ladislaus already held the throne of Bohemia, and thus the two countries were jointly ruled. The ineffectiveness of this king increased the tension in the already divided ranks of the Hungarian nobility. This division was manifested in the desire of the Western nobility to maintain greater voice in the affairs of state they had under Matthias Corvinus, versus the attempts of the old oligarchy to regain their former prominence. This clash of interests created deep political division and constant tension. The economic state was just as unstable, for the country was on the verge of bankruptcy. The royal treasury was empty, new taxes were almost impossible to levy, the customary sources of royal revenue fell off, and the towns declined in size and wealth. The oppression by the nobility of the lower classes became so unbearable that in 1514 spawned the most bloody and extensive insurrection of the peasantry ever to occur in the history of Hungary. The ensuing suppression of this revolt and the subsequent imposition of perpetual serfdom upon the peasants added to the already deep-seated division and prevented unified action against increasingly menacing Turks. Vladislav's son, Louis II, was equally unable to unify the country under his rule and rode into the battle with Suleiman the Magnificent at Mohács with a small and ill-equipped army. The overwhelming defeat and subsequent death of the king left Hungary at the mercy of the Turks, the Habsburgs, and the divided nobility. The turbulence of these 36 years does not seem to reflect in the state of education or the intellectual level of the nation. The intellectual ferment of the reign of Matthias continues to thrive despite the decline evident in other areas. Under the rule of Matthias's successors, the centers of Renaissance study moved from the royal court to episcopal seats and spread among the officials of the chancery.